Welcome to Podcasts on Demand, a continuing medical education activity. This activity includes the most recent and current clinical data presented by leading experts. If you are seeking continuing education credit, please review the disclosures and the requirements for a successful completion of the activity prior to listening to the podcast. A link is found in the podcast description that can direct you to this information.
Thank you for joining us for Talking PAH. Updates from the 7th World Symposium. And we really are appreciative of you being here with us. And we want to thank our sponsors, United Therapeutics, Bayer, Merck, and Actelion, for making this happen. I'm Dr. Jean Elwing, and I'm a professor of medicine and the director of the Pulmonary Hypertension Program at the University of Cincinnati. And I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Oksana Shlobin, who's the medical director of the Pulmonary Hypertension Program, the Director of Outreach and Education at the Advanced Lung Disease Program and at INOVA Fairfax. So what do we want to share with you over this hour? Is we want to describe some important research highlights from the 2024 World Symposium. We want to compare updates from the World Symposium with current practices to identify potential areas for improvement in patient management. And we want to discuss clinical implications of the research highlighted at this meeting. Our agenda is really to give you an overview of the 7th World Symposium, talk about clinical classifications, risk stratification, algorithms, emerging therapies, and clinical trials, and talk about imaging and genetics in the right ventricle. So we're going to cover a lot of ground, and we hope to do that in a very engaging way. So we're glad you joined us. So we're going to talk first about the introduction of this meeting and the goal of a patient perspective playing a major role. So I'm going to start with a question. What was the primary goal of the 7th World Symposium? Is it A, to refine the classification system for pulmonary hypertension? B, to develop global collaborations in PH research? C, to improve diagnostic tools and treatment strategies? D, all of the above? Or E, I'm not really certain, that's why I'm here. Looks like we're getting some answers. What do you think, Oksana?
I think it's all of the above.
Okay, we are doing good so far. So that's great. So what are the goals of this meeting? It's really to foster constructive scientific interactions and collaborations amongst the world's top experts in pulmonary hypertension to drive the field forward. And the World Symposium has been going on for a number of years, with the first meeting in 1973 and has occurred at least more than 5 years between each meeting. And we're on the 7th version of this meeting, and it has shown us progress in PH science and patient care. So let me give you a little bit of an overview. It's a lot of information, but gives you a sense of our progress. So 1960. Geneva. That was the first WHO committee for cor pulmonale, which was, of course, right heart failure in Geneva, Switzerland. What did they do? Their outcomes were to provide the first definition and classification of disease leading to right ventricular hypertrophy and pulmonary vascular disease. And they broke it down into three major groups: lung disease, pulmonary vessel disease, and primary cardiac disease. And this report that they created laid the foundation for the modern understanding of pulmonary hypertension and emphasized the need for research on the interaction between the heart and the lungs. So that's where it started with the WHO, 1960. The first meeting we refer to as the World Symposium, 1973 in Geneva. And that meeting really helped us understand what was happening with this surge of PH cases linked to the anorexigen drug Ametrex. And this is when the term PPH, primary pulmonary hypertension, was born. This symposium highlighted the need to differentiate PH from other forms of heart and lung disease and emphasized the role of medications and medication research. And it triggered the creation of the first registry for pulmonary hypertension from the NIH in the 1980s, which helped us understand the foundation of disease prevalence and outcomes. And there were 17 people at that meeting. Now, the next meeting was a little bit longer than 5 years, as I mentioned, 1998 in Evian. And in this meeting, the focus was on PAH and related conditions. They established the PAH term. Remember, it was PPH and now it's PAH, to broaden the understanding of associated risk factors. And they really talked about the associated conditions like connective tissue disease, congenital heart disease, and they helped understand how to evaluate patients with non-invasive echocardiograms. And they looked at six-minute walk testing for functional assessment. And the meeting marked the beginning of targeted treatments with calcium channel blockers and prostacyclins. And there were 85 people at that meeting. All right, going on to 2003 in Venice. And this meeting was the Third World Symposium, and it talked about advancements in the cellular and molecular understanding of PAH. Key outcomes here, we're understanding the role of BMPR2 gene mutations, and it was identified as a major cause of heritable PAH. And it introduced the first evidence-based treatment algorithm, so that was a big deal. And it included new targets such as endothelin, nitric oxide, and the prostacyclin pathways. And it led to major progress in the understanding of the genetic basis of PAH and really accelerated the development of targeted therapies. And there were 200 PAH specialists at that meeting. Now going on to 2008, Dana Point. That meeting was the Fourth World Symposium. And really the focus was on genetic discoveries and risk assessment. And you can kind of see what we're doing now play out through these meetings. It emphasized the role of BNP and echo and hemodynamic measurements. And it started with a sequential therapy discussion, and that was in the algorithm, using multiple medications for the treatment of PAH based on severity. And it marked the shift towards more sophisticated diagnosis and treatment algorithms. And there were 350 PAH specialists who attended that meeting. Now going on to 2013 in Nice, France. That was the Fifth World Symposium, focused on advancing clinical care and translational research in PAH. And now we've gone from sequential to combination therapy in the algorithm that was produced by that meeting. And they also emphasized the use of catheter-based balloon angioplasty for inoperable chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension and highlighted the need for aggressive initial interventions and set new benchmarks for treatment of PH and CTEP. And there were more than 1,000 PH specialists at that meeting. Now going on to the Sixth World Symposium, again in Nice, France, and reevaluated definitions. We changed our definitions of disease in that meeting and lowered the threshold for diagnosis of PH from 25 or greater mean pulmonary pressure to greater than 20, and really stressed the use of risk assessment tools and screening of patients who are at high risk for development of disease. And now going on to what we're going to be really focusing on in this meeting is the Seventh World Symposium in Barcelona. And what was the goal there? To really focus on innovation, risk stratification, and patient involvement. And that's what Oksana and I are going to be talking with you about today. It was a wonderful meeting, very well put together. And we produced, through that collaboration of all the experts, a document. And that's what we're going to really try to summarize for you. But one focus that was very important is patient-centered care. And for the first time, the symposium started with the patient perspective and highlighted their role in shaping pulmonary hypertension. But in order to focus on patients, we've got to understand what we are missing. We are not touching patients throughout the world. There's a significant disparity between multiple different areas of the world in terms of diagnosis and treatment. And there's a lack of specialist care in many parts of the world. Even in the US itself, there's areas that do not have access to easily reach a PAH specialist. And there's medication availability differences between many different parts of the world, especially in the low resource countries. So in order to focus on patients, we have to understand the shortcomings of our current situation. We do have people and groups working on this. We have social networks, we have patient support groups that are critical for advocacy, education, and peer support. And there is global awareness, and we're trying to make this known that this is a disease that needs to be recognized and evaluated through World Pulmonary Hypertension Day and Pulmonary Hypertension Awareness Month. And we are collaborating amongst our groups of PH support for patients, and we are trying to influence policies and improve care through those advocacy groups. So how do we know how our patients are doing, and what are we using to look at patient-reported outcome measures? Well, there are several tools. You may not be familiar with any of them, but if you are, which one are you utilizing in the care of your pulmonary hypertension patients? A, CAMFER, B, pH Simpact, C, emphasis 10, D is EQ5D or SF36, or E, I don't routinely use these assessment tools in my management of pulmonary hypertension. Are you surprised by these answers, Oksana?
Many people do not use these tools in their everyday care. Often we see them used in research, and that's something obviously that we need to work on in the future.
So kind of a little bit of spread. People are either not using a tool at this time, or they're using emphasis 10 or Simpact. So that's great information. So we know really where we're at. So why aren't we using these? The usage is limited, but growing. We're learning that we can use these tools to help us understand different aspects of care, improve communication, and really ask questions we may not usually get at through our assessment of patients in clinic. Why don't people use tools to understand these outcomes? Lack of time, resources, maybe they're not available, or there's difficulty implementing them. So all of these things create a little bit more work in clinic, but once you would get them through your regular workflow, it would be something that could be implemented if that is something you would be interested in. So important things to be aware of. So Oksana, I'm going to let you take it from here and give us the overview of the Seventh World Symposium. But before that, do you have anything to say about the outcome measures we were talking about? Any tricks or tips on how to use them in clinic?
As you said, Jean, you already mentioned, it is something that at this point tends to be a little bit time consuming. So automation would be something that would definitely help put it into the workflow. I think there's work to be done.
Definitely. So take it from here. Thank you.
All right, great. So I'm going to give you a quick overview of the Seventh World Symposium, and then we're going to sort of get into the nitty-gritty details. So the Seventh World Symposium took place at the end of June in Barcelona, Spain. And the emphasis really was the multidisciplinary and international collaboration. A big highlight was that it was endorsed by a number of global international scientific organizations, so such as ERS and International Society of Heart and Lung Transplant, but also patient-oriented or patient-centric organizations such as Pulmonary Hypertension Association in Europe and the United States and other countries. So at the World Symposium, there were 15 working groups with 129 task force members, and there were 1,700 attendees, and they really included both pulmonary hypertension specialists and researchers, patients representatives, and also pharmaceutical company representatives as well. Again, as Jean already mentioned, this collaboration really cemented this global commitment to tackling PH both through innovation research and innovative ways to educate and various healthcare initiatives. So the goals of this symposium was to advance global knowledge of PH through research, clinical guidelines, and emerging therapies. And specifically, there are certain things that we're going to emphasize during the talk. And one of them is changes to classification in pulmonary hypertension. And there were definitely very clinically applicable changes in group 2 and 3. Exploring some of the emerging treatment strategies. So I'm going to talk about a new treatment algorithm, and Jean is going to talk about emerging therapies. They are, again, collaborative efforts that I already mentioned, emphasis on the integration of patients' perspective. So really the emphasis on making a patient a partner in decision-making, and then promotion of education. So the key outcomes of the symposium is a patient-centric care that Jean already mentioned, advances in risk stratification. So we will go through a couple of tools and treatment algorithms, emerging therapies that I already mentioned. And then we're going to quickly mention some of the upcoming imaging techniques, which hopefully will be something that will be used in the next decade. I'm going to pass it on to Jean, who's going to talk about an updated clinical classification of pulmonary hypertension.
Oh, thank you very much. So, what's changed and what hasn't? Well, the definitions of pulmonary hypertension in terms of the hemodynamics have not changed. This is the same as ERS-ESC 2022 guidelines. Overarching, pulmonary hypertension is diagnosed with an elevated pulmonary pressure with a mean greater than 20, all forms of pulmonary hypertension. And then we break it down into what's pre-capillary or coming from the capillary bed. And that is a mean pressure of greater than 20 with this not originating. The pressure is not coming from the left side of the heart. So the wedge is in that normal range, 15 or less. And the pulmonary vascular resistance is elevated. So that's pre-cap. Isolated post-capillary pulmonary hypertension has a high mean pulmonary pressure, an elevated wedge that is driving that pressure, and normal pulmonary vascular resistance of 2 or less. And then you have a combined situation where you have elevated mean pulmonary pressure, elevated wedge, and an elevated pulmonary vascular resistance. And those are a little bit harder to sort out because there's multiple factors oftentimes playing roles in those individuals. And then it did also accept that definition of exercise-induced pulmonary hypertension that was initially included in the 2022 ERS and ESC guidelines. So that remained the same. The other thing that remained the same are the major clinical classifications of pulmonary hypertension. And it's important to note that we're including all forms of pulmonary hypertension when we talk about the World Symposium, and we're trying to break those down into classifications that are easy to utilize and apply to your patients. Pulmonary hypertension is not rare when it's looked at in all forms, and it affects about 1% of the global population. But group 1 PAH is rare. And group 4 chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension is also uncommon. The diseases we see most commonly are related to left heart disease and lung disease. And those are, as I will show you, a little bit clearer in their classifications based on the 7th World Symposium. So what changed in the classification? The big categories, as I mentioned, did not, but some of the details did. In terms of group 1 PAH, long-term calcium channel blocker responders were added back as they behave differently. They have a different prognosis and are treated differently, monitored differently than the PAH patients in general, and were awarded their own subgroup in this classification. The other thing that was changed was the drug and toxins that are associated with PAH. So we have our definite agents that are associated with pulmonary hypertension. We have two new agents that were added, mitomycin, and carfilzomib. And there were some additional drugs and toxins that were added as possible offenders. And it included things like diazoxide and solvents. So just to be aware that we have additional medications that are included and toxins that are included in these either definite or possible categories. Now going on to group two, pulmonary hypertension related to left heart disease. They added a subcategory of cardiomyopathies and specifically listed hypertrophic and amyloid in that subgroup. And they also broke down valvular heart disease to aortic, mitral, and mixed disease because they behave very differently and would be managed differently. And group three, we changed from an approach looking at the functional change to the different categories of disease. COPD, interstitial lung disease, combined pulmonary fibrosis and emphysema, other parenchymal lung disease. And then they broke down a group into non-parenchymal restrictive lung disease with hypoventilation and pneumonectomy as subcategories. Why? Because we manage these diseases differently. The interstitial lung disease-associated pulmonary hypertension is managed differently than COPD or emphysema. So just helping us to better categorize patients with pulmonary hypertension with lung disease. Group four, that was pulmonary hypertension related to pulmonary artery thromboembolic disease and obstructions remained the same. And group five was changed slightly in that it gave a little bit more granularity to the systemic disorders that are included, like sarcoidosis, pulmonary Langerhans cell, and neurofibromatosis type 1. And also included complex congenital heart disease in that group five, as there's multiple mechanisms that are at play in these individuals, and management is not as clear as some of the other groups. So what changed? The core structure is the same, five groups of pulmonary hypertension, but we did make some changes within the subgroups to better understand how these individuals are different and how we would manage them differently based on that individual subgroup. We added back long-term calcium channel blocker responders because of the difference in their management. And in group two, we added some individual subgroups. Group three, we divided it based on diseases rather than functional abnormalities. And we added additional drugs and toxins to the possible and definite causes of pulmonary hypertension. So currently, we have our classifications that are based on epidemiology and clinical classifications and clinical considerations. And we base that based on presentation, hemodynamics, and therapeutic management. In the future, likely this will change over time because we will better understand pathophysiology, genetics, therapeutic responses, and possibly be more personalized in its approach. Future classifications may focus more on the individual level factors, allowing some customized approach to diagnosis and treatment. What's the benefit of that? These man-made groups we have limitations. They're rigid. They may not include individuals that would benefit from a treatment in one group and may eliminate that opportunity for that individual because they're residing in another group. So personalizing approach would enable targeted treatments tailored to the genetic and biologic profile rather than these hard, fast groups we've created over time. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Oksana, who's going to talk to you about risk stratification.
Great. Thank you, Jean. So we're going to start with just a very quick review of the currently available risk stratification tools. Again, for some of you, it's going to be just a summary, and some of you, it may be the first time that you're seeing this course. The REVEAL score is based on the largest U.S. database, REVEAL database, and is used to prognosticate survival of patients at the 12 months, up to 12 months from the time of diagnosis. And it has gone through a number of iterations, and the most recent one that we have is REVEAL 2.0 and REVEAL Lite 2. And you'll see that the difference between those two scores are that the REVEAL Lite 2 does not have non-modifiable factors such as the subgroup of patients, the age, the gender. And so what you have here are the modifiable risk factors, the renal function, self blood pressure, heart rate, function plus, 6 minute walking distance, and BNP, NT-proBNP. And the way this score is scored is that based on the various results for each parameter, there is a number that's assigned to it from minus two to two. They are all added together and then divided by, and then the sum plus six is going to give you the either low risk score, intermediate risk score, and high risk score. And REVEAL score is very granular because you can actually break it down, break each of those categories down to each individual score. And we know that that has a direct correlation with survival. So if you look at the other frequently used score, that comes from a number of the European databases. And originally, one was summarized by the European Society of Cardiology and Respirology, is something that's called three risk strata. Again, you'll see on the left the different parameters of that score. And again, the way that works is that there is a number that's assigned to low risk, which is 1 point, intermediate risk, 2 points, and then the high risk is 3 points. And what you would see on the bottom is the four risk strata, and that's actually broken down into intermediate low and intermediate high, and the intermediate low gets 2 points and intermediate high gets 3 points. And when you have your clinical information, you add all of those points up and then you divide by the number of parameters. And again, the ratio or various ratio cutoffs will sort of put you into the low risk, intermediate low, intermediate high, or high risk category. And what we know is that the patients that fall into those different categories have different outcomes. There has been a number of the studies that looked at the what we call a non-invasive score based on the databases, specifically the French database, and they showed that in their cohort of sort of clean cut PAH patients, there a number of the non-invasive parameters, including functional class, either 1 to 6 minute walking distance, more than 440, and low or normal BNP and NT-proBNP, really had an excellent predictive power for excellent outcomes. So this non-invasive variables is something that is used in really in everyday clinical situation. So the question to you, to the group, is which risk stratification tool do you primarily use in your patients? A, REVEAL 2.0, B, REVEAL Lite 2, C, ESS, ERS 3 risk strata, D, 4 risk strata, or E, I use my own gestalt. Great. So we have 50% of people. Oh, sorry, more responses. So it looks like about 50% of people say REVEAL Lite 2, and this is something that's probably the most commonly used risk stratification tool in the United States. REVEAL 2.0 is the second most commonly used score, and then the three risk strata and four risk strata is behind it. And then 14% of patients said that they use their own gestalt. Now, a word of caution for everyone who answered E is that there have been a number of studies that showed that we are actually not as clinicians, not very good in estimating the risk status for our patients. So I think it's very good to trust your gut, but you also need to do a risk stratification on every patient that comes in, every time when they come in. And that's actually really a backbone of the treatment algorithm. So let's move towards the so sort of the important points of the task force on risk stratification. We know that the scores that use non-invasive tools are very accurate in their predictive ability of good outcomes when they're all in low risk. However, they're not really disease specific, and they're not very individualized. So you have to use them with caution. You may have a scleroderma patient who cannot walk 440 meters, and you may have someone who is very overweight and they're going to have a normal BNP despite being fluid overloaded or having abnormal RV function. So all of that, again, the scores need to be put in a clinical context. For the risk stratification scores to be useful, they must have the prognostic value and reflect severity of RV dysfunction. And we do know that those non-invasive parameters do correlate. They are really biomarkers of the RV dysfunction. And they need to be modifiable by treatment intervention, which is also something that that we see. You know, the data that we have currently is that the echo parameters and hemodynamic parameters actually offer additional information that can be useful to risk stratification tools. There was a publication looking at the REVEAL database that combined the RV parameters and the REVEAL score, 2.0 score, and showed that it can be, it can really help the risk stratification even further when you combine both of those pieces of information. More recently, we also have information about some of the hemodynamic factors that have not been looked at before, including something called stroke volume index. And this data comes from the French registry that is very well characterized, that looked at their very large patient population, over 1,200 patients. And all of the patients in French registry receive right heart catheterization three to 4 months after treatment initiation. And what they found is that in patients in intermediate low risk and intermediate high risk, the certain hemodynamic parameters, including stroke volume index and SVO2, helped further stratify the patients inside those groups. So you can see that the patients who had a low stroke volume index in intermediate low risk, for example, had a much worse mortality at 3 years than the patients who had a normal stroke volume index. And the same thing applies to patients that fell into intermediate high risk group. So this information can be very helpful when you're trying to make clinical decisions in your everyday life. So the task force also highlighted that there are other areas that need to be studied in the future and maybe alternative treatment goals in patients with PAH. So a concept of pulmonary vascular remodeling and right heart remodeling, something that has been talked about in the literature in the past, and there have been various definitions that have been proposed, and there is no clear definition yet, but a goal is to obviously decrease the pulmonary pressure, pulmonary vascular resistance, and allow for better RV to PA coupling. And the way you would theoretically measure coupling is by imaging, whether it's the imaging by echocardiography or the cardiac MRI. So one of the useful ratios that has been validated recently is an echo-assessed ratio of TAPSE to systolic pulmonary artery pressure. A corollary to that is the ratio of the RV free wall strain to, for example, systolic pulmonary artery pressure. So I think this is something that we're going to see in the future. Combination of the risk assessment with both hemodynamic markers and also assessment of coupling or improvement in right ventricular function. So just to summarize what we talked about here, there are easily measured parameters that you can get in your clinic every time you see a patient. And so that's the functional class, 6-minute walk test distance, and NT-proBNP. There are some of the invasive markers that were validated in the past, and some of the new markers that we talked about, such as stroke volume index and SpO2. Just a reminder, when you use those scores, you have to put them in a clinical context and, again, in patient-centric approach to assessment and treatment is very, very, very important. And in the future, hopefully, we're going to see more research in other ways to assess risk. So using, again, for example, imaging, and hopefully in the future, we're going to achieve a goal of normalizing hemodynamics and normalizing RV function with the therapies that are on the horizon, and some of them Jean is going to talk about. So let's move to the treatment algorithm. First, a question. Do you currently initiate therapeutic interventions in patients with a mean pulmonary pressure in the range of 21 to 24 millimeters of mercury? The answers are always, sometimes, rarely, and never. Jean, what do you think about the responses? So we have a little bit of a split. So we have always is 30%, sometimes is 14%, rarely is 24%, sometimes it's 41%, and never is 9%.
Actually, I think it's very interesting. If we would have done this, 4 or 5 years ago, the answer would have been never in all of them. And now we're really increasing awareness of this 20 to 25 range. But unfortunately, we don't have a lot of data to guide us. As you know, we're kind of trying to figure this subgroup out, and they have not been included in our clinical trials that we're using for our current guidelines.
So as Jean just summarized, so the treatment algorithm that was offered at the World Symposium is for patients with group 1 PH with hemodynamically proven pulmonary hypertension with mean pulmonary pressure, including and above 25 millimeters of mercury and PVR more than 3 Wood units. So we do not have any data on treating patients with PH who have a mild disease. So that's something that's a big gap because we have this newly defined pulmonary hypertension cutoffs, which are lower than anyone that we've ever included in the trial. So let's go through the algorithm. So the algorithm uses the risk stratification without specifying how we're going to risk stratify the patient. So again, it's important that you do it. And just probably for consistency, use the risk stratification tool consistently. That's the most important thing. And the initial approach, and again, this is for group 1 PH patients, is to divide them into high risk, because these are the patients that tend to not do well and have very high risk of mortality, short-term mortality, and not high risk. And patients that are high risk should be treated with upfront combination therapy with parenteral prostanoids. So that's either IV or subcutaneous treprostinil or IV epoprostenol, an ERA, and a PDE5 inhibitor. Patients that are not high risk should be treated with an upfront combination ERA and PDE5 inhibitor therapy. Now, the footnote here is that there are going to be patients that are not high risk, but they have very severe RV dysfunction. And again, because there are some limitations in the risk stratification and very high PVR, for example, and very low cardiac index. Those are the patients that, even if they don't fall into the high risk category, should be considered for prostanoid therapy upfront. So again, this is your clinical gestalt plus risk assessment. The important part of the algorithm is that the follow-up risk assessment should be repeated very frequently and no later than 3 to 4 months after you start the therapy. So when you see a patient back, this is when you use the four-strata approach. Again, you can either use the European Society of Cardiology risk assessment tool, or you can use the Reveal risk assessment tool. But just remember that, you know, that you need to look at the cutoffs for this intermediate, low, intermediate, high risk, so the specific numbers. And if the patient improved and they are now low risk, that's great. And again, this is when you want to continue the therapy, make sure that their RV function is improving. If the patient continues to be high risk, then we have now quadruple therapy available to us. So again, if they were already on triple therapy, you'd add sotatercept. And if they were on a dual therapy, then the first drug to add would be parenteral prostanoid. And again, if then they are not improving, add sotatercept on top of it. For patients who are intermediate high risk, if they were not on triple therapy, this is when a decision needs to be made with the patient whether an additional sotatercept versus parenteral prostanoid and which drug to add. You really want to involve a patient into that discussion. And for patients who are intermediate low risk after the initial therapy, this is where you have to have a discussion with the patient, because there are a number of possibilities at this point. You can add sotatercept, you can add an oral prostanoid, you can add an inhaled prostanoid. We theoretically can consider switching a PDE5 inhibitor to riociguat. So again, this patient specific approach is very important. For patients that have persistent RV dysfunction and or remain in intermediate high risk or high risk, these patients should be on quadruple therapy at this point, and they should be referred for lung transplantation evaluation if they are potentially a candidate for lung transplantation. And the emphasis here is that you really need to let a transplant center make that decision rather than making that decision outside of the transplant center, because in transplant centers, we often work very, very hard to make people transplant candidates. So with that, just a summary. Everyone with PAH, majority of patients with group 1 pulmonary hypertension should be on combination therapy. Most of our patients will be started with dual oral therapy. That's, we usually see patients in intermediate risk in our clinic, majority of our patients. Parenteral prostanoid therapy is very important for patients that have very severe disease. We now have 4 drugs, so we are going to see patients on 4 drug therapy, and the early reassessment and escalation is very, very important. Now, we do need more trials. I mean, you noticed in the algorithm that there are recommendations for several options for most of those groups of patients when you have to make your reassessment decision. And so How to choose a correct combination therapy in those situations is something that that we don't know. We don't have the head-to-head comparison trials for many of those strategies. So this is something that still is a work in progress. Jean is going to probably talk about some of the trials with sotatercept, but we do have a trial which is currently being run for the upfront therapy with sotatercept, ERA and PDE5 inhibitor. So it's possible then with the next iteration of guidelines, we may have an upfront triple therapy. So in the future. So to summarize this big section, there are pros and cons of the risk-based approach. We went through some of them. Remember that you need to use the risk assessment, but be aware of who is sitting across from you. So you have to apply them in a patient-specific manner. You have to really use the risk assessment, but not forget about assessing the right ventricle. And hemodynamics can be very important when you try to make those decisions that we talked about and figure out which medication may be the most appropriate for the patients. So just with the, given the, some of the constraints of times, I'm not going to run through the key therapies because Jean is going to highlight some of them in her talk on emerging therapies. So with that, I will turn it over to Jean.
All right, thank you. That was a very nice review. So what we're going to talk about now is the current challenges and where we're going with therapies. So we currently focus on vasodilation, and we're shifting to a model where we're looking at vascular remodeling. But there's challenges. Now we have several therapies. We need to still enroll patients in clinical trials, and it is more challenging to do that in light of additional options for patients. We also have lack of diversity in our trials, so we may not be capturing all of our patients and their backgrounds. And we have evolving strategies and endpoints in trials, which have been changing over time. So things that make it a little bit more challenging when we're looking at new drugs. Our pillars of therapy continue to be our vasodilators, the prostacyclin pathway, the nitric oxide pathway, and the endothelin pathway. But we do have a new pathway, the activin signaling pathway, which is sotatercept, one drug at this time, that is working in a different way. It's working through a biologic means in terms of altering activin. And if we look at all of our options, there's a lot more than there used to be. And so it gets a little bit overwhelming. But what I want to make sure you're aware of, that they have three major divisions in terms of pulmonary vasodilators: endothelin, nitric oxide, and prostacyclin pathways. And then we have our new pathway, the activin signaling pathway. And we use our endothelin and our nitric oxide pathways in combination frequently in our new patients, upfront combination. And we have one new drug that's a combination of both that helps improve adherence and ease of use of medication. So we do have an option where we have a combination tablet. So just looking at this, it lets you know that we have a lot of options, but we really have to be diligent in our evaluation and risk stratification so we know how to use these best together for our patients. But we're not going to stop here. We've allowed ourselves to develop treatment strategies to lower risk and to improve outcomes, but we haven't cured this disease. We're still looking at new pathways, growth factors, tyrosine kinases. We're looking at additional medications in the pathway like sotatercept. We're looking at blocking pathways that may lead to additional changes in the pulmonary vascular bed. So what do we want to do with these new therapies? We want to change what is happening in the vasculature in the patient's lungs with pulmonary arterial hypertension, change that apoptosis, the proliferation, and the endothelin to mesenchymal transition, and the resultant changes in the right heart. So we have a lot of work to do, but we have gone so far, as I mentioned to you when we looked at the changes in what our focus was in the symposiums over time. So we talked a little bit about this new pathway, sotatercept. This is a medication that was studied in phase 2 in Pulsar and phase 3 in Stellar. Phase 3 primary endpoint was time. It was looking at 6-minute walk distance and showed at 24 weeks, we had a significant improvement in our exercise tolerance based on 6-minute walk at that 24-week period when patients were exposed to sotatercept. But it also met many secondary endpoints that were associated with improvement in the patients who were exposed to that therapy. So very exciting times to add a new pathway. So what's in our future? Well, we have things that are ongoing. We're still looking at sotatercept and its place in the pathway of treatment of PAH. We're looking at Hyperion, which is newly diagnosed patients, Zenith, which includes advanced symptom patients, and Soteria, which is long-term patients. We're looking at a study called Tropos, which is another activin signal inhibitor like sotatercept, but having a primary endpoint in phase 2 of PVR, potentially allowing an additional therapy option. And also Prosera, which is looking in phase 3 at seralutinib, which is an inhaled agent, twice daily, looking at a primary endpoint of 6-minute walk distance at 48 weeks. And Advanced Outcomes, which is looking at a novel prostacyclin receptor agonist, ralinepag, which is a once-a-day prostacyclin receptor agonist, and we're looking at time to worsening. And these will hopefully allow us to have additional therapeutic options for our patients as these studies are completed and we determine outcomes. So what are our potential disease modifications and what are our goals? Well, we want to impact the treatment landscape and change the outcome with these new therapies to go from treatment with vasodilation to pulmonary arterial remodeling. And we want to use combination therapies to potentially reduce the burden of long-term pulmonary arterial hypertension and reduce risk of worsening, lower our risk to low risk in all of our patients, and to improve quality and quantity of life. So we want to personalize this over time as we've learned about our patients, and we want to focus on what we're learning in terms of the individual outcomes of patients and tailor with biomarkers and approach to management. We want to innovate and simplify and increase the efficiency of our clinical trials to be able to understand how to use multiple medications and accelerate the time to drugs coming to market. And we want to improve our use of remote monitoring, reach more patients, include more patients through wearables and AI for real-time data collection. So all of these things hopefully will allow us to take what we're doing for our patients in many places in the world and expand it to a more global reach to pulmonary hypertension and enhance the diversity in our patients. And so we can include patients of different backgrounds and ensure that we're using evidence-based information and evidence-based generation to improve outcomes, not only for the patients with that very clear PAH phenotype, but those also who have other comorbidities, which may influence their outcomes. And we want to understand those patients better so we can serve them also as we do our PAH patients without comorbidities. And now I'm going to give it to Oksana to talk about my multimodal imaging.
We'll start with a poll question. What is the primary role of multimodality imaging in the management of pulmonary hypertension patients? A, to replace invasive diagnostic tests entirely. B, to better understand RV function and disease progression. C, to diagnose PH in early symptomatic stages. And D, to monitor only pulmonary artery pressure. So to better understand RV function and disease progression and to diagnose PH in the early asymptomatic stages is the responses that we are getting. All right. Let's see whether this works. Okay, great. So I'm just going to take a couple of minutes to talk about sort of the new or updates on the CT and the MRI. The CAT scans are usually used in patients with pulmonary hypertension when we want to, when we are working them up and phenotyping them specifically to rule out and or diagnose parenchymal lung disease. And one thing that I'd just like to emphasize here is that you really need the high resolution CT scans to evaluate mild parenchymal lung disease, specifically emphysema or mild interstitial lung disease, because often, for example, emphysema can be missed on CT, like a CT angiogram. The newest ketone block is the spectral imaging and the photo counting CT scan. And not only this technology is able to give us extremely high resolution images of parenchymal, but it also allows us for visualization of pulmonary vascular structures. And there are a number of applications. One of them is something called morphometry, which actually has been in one study shown to correlate with response to treatment. So that's something that I think is going to be in the future. The other modality that got a mention in a chapter on CTEF is a CT lung perfusion. We traditionally have used ventilation perfusion imaging to evaluate patients with pulmonary hypertension to ensure that they don't have CTEF. However, dual energy CT scan, so especially the the new third generation dual energy CT scans are probably superior to the information that you get in ventilation with VQ scans, because not only they allow you to see vasculature and small vasculature and distal clots very well, they also give you perfusion maps. So again, this is something that's used in Europe more frequently than the United States, but there have been several studies that showed usefulness in dual energy CT scans. This is something that it is operator dependent and reader dependent. So hopefully we will see a lot more of it in the future. The other modality that I wanted to spend a moment talking about is a MRI. So again, the 4D flow MRI allows us a real-time three-dimensional visualization of blood flow in the pulmonary arterial tree as well as through the right heart chambers, and also allows us to better assess and quantitate function of the right heart failure, of the right heart. And there are a new ways to measure blood flow, and there's been correlation between those measures, such as a vortex flow and wall shear stress, with hemodynamic parameters. And again, more to come on that. So there are a number of centers in the United States are looking at 4D flow MRI. And the last modality that I was going to mention is the dynamic contrast enhanced MRI. And that's an MRI way to assess lung perfusion and blood flow. The data on that is, you know, this is still in the development. And the data on this is not as strong as on dual energy CT scans, but it is something that's being looked at primarily right now for lung perfusion. So like in a CTEF patient, but it also has ability to quantitate perfusion. So that's something that's very cool. So just to summarize, we think that that there are a number of modalities that are going to allow us for deeper phenotyping of our patients before they even come to a right heart catheterization. Also, some of the modalities are going to allow us to monitor treatment as well. also help us with early diagnosis. So for patients, for example, with scleroderma, for a photon counting CT scan has an inability to detect development of microvasculopathy way before you have elevation of pulmonary pressure and elevation of pulmonary vascular resistance. So with that, I am going to turn it over to Jean, and she's going to spend a couple of minutes on our next topic.
So we'll wrap it up with our genetics and our RV. A big topic, but we're going to go and focus on what was some major advances over time. So genetics, very important. Increasingly, we are aware of this. BMPR2, which I mentioned earlier, it affects 70 to 80% of familial pulmonary hypertension, but is also found in 20 to 40% of idiopathic cases. But there's multiple other genes that we're becoming aware of that play a role in vasculopathy and remodeling. Also, genomics and physiology are in great interplay. The genomics studies have uncovered that genetic variations affect pulmonary vascular hemostasis and lead to our better understanding of how the vascular remodeling and inflammation is playing a role in our pulmonary hypertension patients. And we're not in a vacuum. Epigenetics are also playing a role that change our DNA methylation, impact gene expression, and contribute to pH progression. So understanding that more will help us in time to change our therapies in the future, understanding this basis of genetics and the interplay of genetics and our outcomes. So what about the RV? The RV is a primary determinant of outcomes and extremely important in outcomes in terms of our pulmonary hypertension patients for the long term. So what do we know about our physiology? The right ventricle initially adapts and then becomes maladaptive over time with the chronic high pressures of pulmonary hypertension. And there's fibrosis and inflammation that are occurring in the right ventricle and metabolic derangements. And targeting that, hopefully in the future, will become new targets for outcomes in our patients. So RV failure correlates with poor prognosis in our patients, and patients with lower RV ejection fraction have worse outcomes. And so hopefully making this a potential target in the future can impact the overall outcomes of our patients. So looking at this genetics, RV function, and how we transition this to patient outcomes, well, really, we have to take what we know, and we've talked about treating PAH, but also taking into account that there's genetic basis of disease we have to be aware of. The RV function has to be taken into account, and we need to monitor the RV through the imaging modalities we've discussed, and we need to take that into account in terms of outcomes and a potential target for therapies. And putting it all together, hoping that knowing this information and targeting these areas could improve our overall outcomes of our patients, personalizing care, and impacting long-term survival. So with that, we're going to look at a few questions. We do have one question in the chat, and that is about people with comorbidities. And something that we're grappling with a little bit and trying to sort out how we best manage patients with comorbidities and look at them from a PAH perspective, but also addressing the other issues that may be affecting their outcomes. Oksana, do you have any words of wisdom about comorbidities?
This specific comorbidity of the sleep apnea that is mentioned in the question. So the question is, I have a precapillary patient with significant pulmonary hypertension, mean PA pressure of 34 and pulmonary vascular resistance of 6 foot units, and the only workup that was positive is severe OSA. And this patient I assume is in the intermediate risk category. So do you wait and treat OSA or do you start the therapy? So the most recent guidelines do not have OSA as an etiology of pulmonary hypertension. We know it is a comorbidity in various cardiac diseases or entities such as congestive heart failure and pulmonary arterial hypertension. So now, of course, we do know that patients who have OSA are also often have things like diastolic dysfunction. So, you know, when you have someone with extensive cardiac comorbidities, you do want to phenotype a patient very well and make sure that you are not dealing with a pre- and post-capillary pulmonary hypertension, and they really have pre-capillary disease, but they are normal left ventricle and normal left atrium. And if you do have risk factors such as systemic hypertension and obesity and OSA and diabetes, these are the patients where we often do provocative testing on the heart catheterization, such as fluid challenge. And you definitely want to look at that echocardiogram. Because remember, you can do a right heart catheterization and they may have a normal wedge, but if they haven't been eating and they've been diuresed quite a lot, you may miss this diastolic heart failure as a cause of their pulmonary hypertension. Now, let's say that this patient does not have any diastolic heart failure and they just have an OSA. You would treat their pulmonary hypertension, you treat their OSA at the same time. What we have seen clinically is that often patients' OSA actually gets better as you treat their pulmonary hypertension. But I think that Jean probably would agree with me that you wouldn't just treat OSA and wait to see what happens.
Yeah. I think globally managing the patients is really important because we can't treat one without the other. But I would not just treat the OSA because, as Oksana said, don't think it can explain the current situation of this patient. So we do have one more question, and then we'll go on to wrap it up. So with the shift towards combination therapy with PAH, what are the practical challenges in implementing these updated algorithms across diverse healthcare settings, especially with limited resources to advance therapies? So that is a really, really important question. And it's near and dear to all of us that manage pulmonary hypertension because we would like to say we are reaching everyone, but we know that is not the case. So this is one time I think I'll say a little, and I'm going to ask Oksana to say a little bit about this. I think really what we want to do here is to make sure we have the greatest reach we can working through virtual visits and our partners in the community where our patients live. They might be 3-4 hours away, but that's the only way we're able to provide care to many patients who are in remote regions or have limited access. And those people who are in our own communities, we have to work with our social work and our support systems that we have to be able to provide them care and additional resources that will help them to be able to get to appointments and to be able to access the care they need. So what other things would you have to add?
Well, actually, Jean summarized it very well. In the East Coast, even on the East Coast, where we have a lot of centers, we have patients who sometimes live 3 or 4 hours away. But if you sort of go into the center of the country, there are patients sometimes that have to travel 4, 5, 6 hours to get to the PH center. And we definitely partner with smaller pulmonary hypertension centers in the state where I am and also the surrounding states and develop very good working relationship with them, with the other providers, to make sure that if there is a complicated question, patient, they always can pick up a phone and talk it out with one of us. So that really only goes to the education of other providers. The issues that Jean mentioned are very real, and we definitely have patients who don't have resources to make a long trip, which makes taking care of them more complicated. So we work with our social workers, we work with insurances. There are a number of organizations that have some funding for patients to help with medications and travel. So we sometimes tap into that.
Thank you. That was really good. I think that we were able to touch on some really important points with those questions. So I'm going to ask Oksana to finish it up and summarize the key points from the discussion.
I think we pretty much covered them all. So I'm just going to put the slide up for everyone. Remember that pulmonary hypertension can be a rapidly progressive disease. We have a multitude of medications, which makes it also easier and more difficult to take care of the patients. The patient-centric approach really was highlighted in the Seventh World Symposium. Although the goal is to achieve and maintain a low-risk status, it's important to think about the right ventricle, so normalizing right ventricular function, improving hemodynamics as much as possible. Really, the goal would be to normalize hemodynamics. And I think the last two points on the slide we have just talked about as an answer to someone who asked a very important question already about the challenges in care access and addressing those and really making them a part of the treatment strategy for each individual patient.
So we really appreciate you joining us. Oksana and I had a great time talking with you about the World Symposium, and have a wonderful rest of the evening.
We hope you found this podcast useful and educational. To receive continuing education credit and to download your printable certificate, please go to the activity page at practice.cme.com to complete the post-test and evaluation to receive continuing education credit.